Yep.
Danny Hillier?
Who's this?
If you want a real story, you should ask the police what is happening in the Eurotunnel.
Well, why don't you tell me what's happening in the Eurotunnel?
You're supposed to be a journalist, Danny. But I'll give you a clue. They found half an MP and half a prostitute.
Yeah, very funny, Johnny. Listen, as I said, it'll be with you by five, all right?
That's The Tunnel, the French-British crime drama series that's just begun airing on ABC One on Sunday nights. It's adapted from the 2011 Danish-Swedish series The Bridge, which became a worldwide critical success. There's also been an American adaptation set between the US and Mexico. But The Bridge is just one of a number of TV shows, including The Killing and Borgen, as well as films and books that have been constructing a dark vision of the European North, as well as a growing Scandinavian mania. From furniture and knitwear to foraged food and ultra-gourmet restaurants, it seems there's an insatiable desire for all things Nordic. Britain even has a Nordic Noir magazine, and Channel 4 recently aired a three-part series, Scandamania. But what's driving this interest? Is it just a few ideas, a kind of vibe thing about grey skies and functional design, and a relatively civilised set of gender politics? Or is there something deeper at work? Has it got something to do with race identity? Ben Pitcher has an interest in race and its relationship with culture, including the current attraction to all things Nordic. He's the author of Consuming Race and also a senior lecturer at the University of Westminster in London. Hi, Ben, and welcome
Hello,
to The List.
Cassie. Yeah. Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you say that popular culture is saturated with racial meanings, and that when we're consuming something like a TV show like The Bridge, we're also consuming ideas about race, like our own and others. Tell us how this happens.
That's right. Well, when people talk about race, they tend to think simply about direct acts of prejudice and discrimination. And this is really important, but race is about a whole lot more than this. And racial meanings are an intrinsic part of our everyday lives. And that's the case whether we're black or white, whether we're racist or anti-racist, whether we're Chilean or Chinese. And what I do in Consuming Race is to look at ordinary acts of consumption and think about how racial meanings get produced in consumer culture, in things like the services we employ, the products we buy, the places we go to, and indeed the TV we watch, the music we listen to, and the games we play. Now, these things are often dismissed as kind of trivial or insignificant to the real business of race, but actually they're very important sites of racial meaning. And one example of this, as you suggest, is the contemporary fashion for Nordic culture.
So how does this work when I'm watching one of these shows, you know, and I might be thinking, oh, I wonder where they got those chairs from, you know, they IKEA, or, you know, is that what you mean? Is that the kind of really concrete example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, my starting point here is a kind of turn away from the cosmopolitan. It used to be more fashionable than it is now to be the consumer of certain kinds of cultural difference. Now, this is more frowned upon. There was a thing with the American musician Pharrell Williams wearing a Native American headdress on the front cover of the UK edition of Elle magazine, and he was taken to task for this. It was considered kind of insulting and disrespectful of Native American culture. And I think this is an interesting thing, that these kind of cosmopolitan manoeuvres have been replaced more by a kind of respect for difference, in that we're all encouraged to get in touch with our own roots. So let's say we're of Ghanaian heritage, it's a great and good thing to get in touch with Ghanaian fashion or theatre or music. If we're from Ecuador or Peru, to get in touch with Latin American traditions is encouraged in our culture. And these are investments in what I call ethnically appropriate forms of culture, culture that in some sense is said to belong to us. This gives us meaning and gives richness to our lives. Now, this fashion for ethnically appropriate culture poses, I suggest, a problem for white people, and particularly in 21st century Britain, this is where I'm coming from, because, of course, an idea of white culture is indelibly marked by the racism of the far right. It's a very racially exclusive thing. So people who wrap themselves in the George's flag or some of the other exclusionary accoutrements of nationalism, people don't want to do this. most white people in contemporary Britain don't want to be racist. But the logic of ethnic appropriateness, of kind of getting in touch with your roots, of finding yourself in some sense, requires that white people engage with these ideas about roots or origins, of trying to say who they're from, where they're from, who they are in the context of multicultural societies. And this, I think, is where the fashion for Nordic culture comes in.
Mm, so in the place of any other notable ethnicity, people are drawing on histories of cultural migrations over millennia and identifying with that.
Yeah, it's not a literal thing. It's a kind of symbolic affiliation. But yeah, Nordic culture provides a solution to a kind of crisis of white identity in multicultural Britain, because it provides an idea of where white culture comes from. It provides a location for an idea of a legitimate white culture. You know, there's a long-standing association between whiteness and the North in the Romantic imagination. It's there in High German Romanticism, it's there in Gothic. The North is a place of coldness, but it's also a place of certain kinds of values and characteristics of clarity, of precision, of rationality, of cleanliness. So a journey to the North is a kind of journey to the origins or the home of whiteness. Now, that's a literal whiteness of kind of cold, snowy ice, but it's also a symbolic journey to the values of whiteness. And I think one of the things that I do in Consuming Race is to think about how these ideas about white culture and white values get produced in everyday consumer culture.
So when we think of Scandinavian attributes such as great investment in education, fairness in access to workplace and childcare, and all those kind of very advanced ideas of civilization, that's partly what people are consuming, that they're attracted to, rather than ideas of, as you say, gun-toting, flag-wearing ideas of whiteness.
Yeah, exactly. It gives a model of whiteness, a kind of fantasy of whiteness that people find immensely attractive. I mean, just to give you some examples that help to explain this, in contemporary consumer culture, we find ideas about the cold, precise, rational northern aesthetic being associated with modernist design, as you mentioned in your introduction, the kind of clean lines and functionality of mid-century Scandinavian furniture. This stuff is very desirable. I mean, my home would be full of it too if I had the money. And there's an idea here that by owning and exhibiting this furniture, white people are at the same time kind of associating themselves with the characteristics of a Nordic whiteness. It kind of rubs off on them. It says something about who they are. Now, this might not be a problem if it wasn't for the fact that these are such insistently kind of racialized identifications. You know, notions of white culture as functional, as modest, as appropriate, even as kind of conservative and boring, are being set up here in oppositions to notions of ostentatious, consumerist black culture. I mean, think of the kind of showy African-American culture of bling, for example. This is something the American scholar Rupali Mukherjee writes about, that white people, by saying kind of less is more, they're developing a kind of positional advantage here. We see it too in the fashion for Nordic cuisine. The world-famous Danish restaurant Noma, for example, has this focus on sustainability and locality. And in the background here, I can't help but think, is an idea of racial others, particularly racial others in what gets called the global south, living unsustainably, rapidly industrializing, living in kind of polluting and unsustainable ways. So my point here is that these seemingly positive traits of Nordic culture, ideas about kind of modesty and sustainability, have this rather disturbing racial underbelly. Fantasies of Nordic culture help to reinforce actually very problematic ideas of white cultural superiority. And I think Nordic noir is part of this fashion too.
Mm. How did you start to think about this? Was it while you were watching Scandinavian shows and noticing your own responses?
Yeah, exactly. It was exactly through sitting down, watching, I think it was The Bridge that I watched first, and then The Killing. And it was trying to sort of unpack what it was about these shows that was seemed to be so attractive. You know, it's a very interesting thing, because in the Nordic countries, Nordic noir, when it developed in the 70s in literature, was a kind of critique of social democracy. It was a way of saying that the Nordic societies were kind of rotten to the core. But in contemporary Britain, and I think other places and spaces in the world, we watch shows like The Bridge and The Killing, and, you know, murderers and killers aside, we're actually really excited by what we see. You know, we lust over people's modernist kitchen furniture. We get excited about how much paternity leave they get. We indulge some kind of, you know, I say this as somebody that got, you know, 2 weeks. We indulge some idealized fantasies of Nordic culture, of Nordic style, of Nordic attitudes, of Nordic politics. The idea of Nordic social democracy is still very kind of aspirational as a model of social and political organization. So, you know, what Nordic noir does is bring all these elements together into a single package. Nordic culture provides a kind of fantasy of what white people are like when they're left to their own devices. You know, it's a fallacy here, but there's this strong idea that the Nordic countries are predominantly white places. And so we have ideas about white people producing a specific kind of culture within the social, geographical and climactic conditions of the North. Now, this isn't real. You know, the reality is far different from this. In reality, the Nordic countries aren't as ethnically homogenous as this. They have all kinds of social problems. But as I've suggested, Nordic culture seems to provide a kind of answer to a crisis of white identity. It provides us with a set of cultural and aesthetic resources that are incredibly attractive to us. And we should think critically about our excitement for what seems to be such a wonderful place.
But one of the other things you say is that ideas about race are often very different to what we might say or think, and that race doesn't just go away, and that it's an identity that remains present whether we acknowledge it or not. That even though I might say, I don't see black and white, I just see the person. We are all operating on kind of ideas about race. And in fact, it's far more fluid rather than fixed.
That's right, yeah. I think, you know, even when we deny race, we sort of push it to the background. We say we don't see it. We're kind of lying to ourselves. And of course, you know, there is the anti-racist truth that in kind of biological terms, there is no such thing as race. Yeah, race is a fiction. It's a fantasy. It's it has a kind of social existence, but it has no kind of biological proof. And yet, of course, race continues to exist. It has this massive part to play in our cultures. So race is more not something that we have, but more something that we do. We tend to sort of close down discussion of race out of fear of saying the wrong thing, perhaps. Now, race is about racism, and I come at this from an anti-racist perspective. But I think in order to do anti-racism properly, we need to understand all those other things that race does too. You know, it's about communicating our hopes, our fears, our desires. Race can provide us ways of engaging with difference. It can be a way of exploring new ways of being a human being, of kind of trying on new perspectives and having new experiences. And I strongly feel we need to find ways of talking about these wider meanings of race without closing them down always to a question about who's being racist against whom.
Well, Ben Pitcher, I think you've got a long way to uncovering what it is behind this fascination and this intense interest in the Nordic storytelling. Thank you very much for being a guest on the list today.
Thank you, Cassie.
That's Ben Pitcher. He's the author of Consuming Race and a senior lecturer in the sociology department of the University of Westminster in London.